Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to have some folks from the Interfaith Peace Builders delegation that recently returned to the United States from Israel and the West Bank. I'm very happy now to welcome Darius Himes. He is acquiring editor at Radius Books right here in Santa Fe. And Radius has published a new wonderful book called Land Art New Mexico. And there will be a presentation of the book at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe on Tuesday, the 6th of July at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. Happy to be here.
Thanks. So it's this book is called Land Art, Land/Art. And it encompasses a whole lot of different levels of art and thinking. This book came together as the result of a whole lot of projects that happened in the state of New Mexico.
Exactly. Back in the summer and fall of 2009, just last year, there was a sort of statewide exhibition that brought together just short of 30 different arts organizations all around the state. The project was initiated by Bill Gilbert and Kathleen Shields. Bill is the Bill holds the Lannan Chair in Land Arts of the American West down at the University of New Mexico in the Department of Art, and has been involved with land arts for a great many years. And Kathleen Shields is an independent writer and curator, also has been involved with land arts for a long time, and she's, for example, she's the administrator of the Lightning Field for the Dia Foundation, which is one of the great pieces of land art from the 70s.
If you don't mind, describe the Lightning Field, because I think that's a great point of entry for somebody who might be listening and saying, what is land art?
Right. That's a great question. I'm happy to describe it. The Lightning Field is a piece by Walter de Maria. It is a sculpture, essentially, and I would almost say an experiential work of art that sits out in a part of New Mexico that is just past the Very Large Array in the southern half of the state. It's in a very remote location, and it is a 1 mile by 1 kilometer grid of, I'm going to maybe not hit all of the exact details about the piece, but essentially they are brushed aluminum rods.
Lightning rods.
They're essentially lightning rods, exactly. And they sit in a grid pattern out in this landscape. And the one element, one of the sort of conceptual pieces, elements of this piece, is that the tops of all of these rods hit the same plane. So in other words, you would be able to lay a flat piece of glass on top of all of these rods, and it would touch the top
right.
of every rod. The piece itself, I think, rarely, it's not like it attracts lightning, but it sits out in this landscape where you have this 360-degree view of not only the work itself, but simply the landscape and the horizon. And it's a, for anybody that's been out there, they know that it's you go for just about a 24-hour period. You go and you stay overnight. It's administered by the Dia Foundation. And it's really quite a contemplative experience that uses, I would have to say, it uses materials to draw your attention to the land and the environment.
But usually people who do go there do see lightning.
Actually, no.
No?
That's one of the sort of like, it's almost like a misnomer, but it's an enigmatic piece, if anything. I mean, it's beautiful. One of the things that a lot of people who go out there talk about is the fact that the metal poles, your perception of them sort of shifts throughout the course of the day, from high noon when they're almost barely visible in the landscape to the later afternoon light. And the metal, this very man-made kind of material, if anything, it heightens the experience of the natural environment. And that point for me is one of the strongest points about land art, is that there is a man-made activity that then circles around and draws us back to our attention being placed on the natural environment and our human interaction with the world, with the land.
One of the things that Lucy Lepard points out in her essay in this book, there are some very nice essays in the book that you have published, is that there is a difference in, well, the times have changed since people started doing land art in the 1960s, and also the way the land is being used has changed so much. Describe the original kind of ideas and feeling behind the land art movement.
I think the original genre really was, and while I'm no expert on it, I'm sort of just speaking from this an editorial viewpoint, it was very much about an interaction with space. It was a movement out of the studio, out of the sort of site where so much art was being produced, moving, you know, here we are in the early 70s, and there's figures like James Turrell with Rodin Crater in Arizona, which is a monumental artwork, land artwork. We've talked a little bit about Walter de Maria's The Lightning Field, and then also something like Robert Smithson's Spiral Jetty, which is on the edge of the Great Salt Lake. It was a desire to, again, to work with a raw material that was not a studio practice. It was about being out in the land. It was about drawing attention to the environment. Obviously, there was also the a sort of renewed interest in really in the environment. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of things that played into that. And so, yeah, Lucy, who's an amazing writer and has been a champion of land art from very early on, amongst other things that she's championed, and who is, you know, she resides here in Galisteo.
And we just had her on the other day talking about her new book about the Tano Indians of Galisteo.
Exactly. And so she's somebody who has a decades-long sort of view of the genre. And her essay really does talk about our shifting perceptions about the land, about the environment, about what constitutes an art practice. And one of the reasons that that the title for the book is at least typographically treated in such a different way, you know, it's land slash art.
Right.
We didn't want people to pick it up and feel like they were going to get some sort of history lesson about the, quote, land art from the 70s, but that it's really looking at contemporary practice today that is really inspired by the land art of the 70s, but which has moved beyond. It's somewhat syncretic in the sense of it has brought together all of these ideas, you know, from the past and moved them forward, sort of standing on the shoulders of these giants, but that it has now very much, and looking through the work in the book, the practice has very much seeped down to a intimate level. You know, Rodin Crater by Turrell and The Lightning Field by Walter de Maria and Spiral Jetty, these are all massive, massive projects. So many of the projects, and they're not ephemeral. They are like these...
They're there for a long
they
time.
They are very permanent. You know, I mean, Turrell is transforming an entire, you know, geologic crater, you know, in northern Arizona. And he has been trying to do that for the last couple of decades. But so much of the work in the book has a very ephemeral quality. And I think that's an important part of today's practice.
We're talking to Darius Himes about the new book, Land Art. I think one of the things that is interesting also is that the land is so full of basically nature's works of art that the question arises, why do you want to add anything to it in the first place? Particularly the West, which has been, as one of your essayists, William Fox, points out, painted and really made into the kind of picturesque set of paintings and monuments and so on that we associate with the West and the natural beauty. Yeah, paint it. Yeah, photograph it. But why add anything to it?
That's a great question. I think the question actually, to dig a little bit onto a deeper level with it, I think you're asking almost like what is the role of art? How can, what can a work of art do for our understanding of our environment, of our role in society, and also of the planet and of the environment. As you were talking about that, I was thinking about Agnes Martin's paintings and her work, which is so very rooted in this place in northern New Mexico.
Although I have to say, I mean, for those who haven't seen Agnes Martin's work, it's a lot of parallel lines and occasionally grids and things like that. And if you didn't know what you just said, that it's rooted in the land here, you would not have the foggiest idea.
Exactly, which I think is, in my mind, it's okay in the sense that she takes something that is so quintessentially Western in some senses, this idea of the vast horizon and the vastness that is associated with the American West. She takes that and abstracts it in a way where the horizon and the grid of sort of trying to understand this space, she abstracts it into this meditation. And I think this the fact that so much of the land art movement is rooted with and placed in the American West, I think that's so important, particularly because it's such a different landscape than the East. I mean, how many times have we heard people who have like grown up in New England or grown up on the East come out West and just talk endlessly about the vastness of the sky and the vastness of, you know, the horizon and the views. And so in my mind, the role that the arts can play in somehow distilling these feelings or distilling these ideas about space and land, I think that art can somehow heighten our awareness. It's almost like being able to, you know, there's nothing, there's almost nothing better than simply going out and hiking and seeing some of the grand vistas for yourself. But at the same time, it's almost like to nurture an appreciation of that, I think art can play a very big role in that it distills down a particular idea or a particular essence of the land, for instance, and presents it.
Well, you probably wouldn't be using the word grand vista if it weren't for 19th century paintings.
That's true. That's a very good point. I think art has played an educative role throughout time. Part of it is even before travel was so easy, you know, you've got the idea that art, you know, images can take us to places we won't ever be able to visit. But at the same time, the history of 20th century art is very much about the abstract, and it's so idea-based, not just trying to replicate a view of nature, but really try to distill something out of it. So I think that part, that plays into it.
So when we talk about some of the, in this book, Land Art New Mexico, and as you flip through the book, you realize that some of the pieces are in galleries, and it's not all taking place outdoors by any means, and some of them are paintings and photographs and so on. Tell us about some of your favorite projects that went into the making of this book.
That's a great question as well. There are my own personal background is with photography, and some of my familiarity is with photography. So there are several my favorite photographers who are based here in New Mexico that were involved. Michael Berman is a photographer who's based outside of Las Cruces and has been really sort of wandering through and through that sort of southwest quadrant of our state that is also vast and barren, and has been photographing and really producing almost like a portrait of the region in a way that I think is fantastic. He's somebody that has been supported by the Lannan Foundation here in town and has had a couple of books recently on his own.
Now that's an interesting, his work is interesting because there was a show a couple of years ago in which he participated, which was about the border, and it highlights the fact that with a lot of what seems like pure landscape, there's political stuff intertwined with it.
Definitely. And that actually sort of is an easy segue into David Taylor's work. David Taylor is the chair of the photography department at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. And he has been working on a project that started out as a survey of border monuments that were installed in the late 19th century. So it's a fascinating project where from the El Paso Juarez area all the way out to the Pacific, there are roughly 275 cast iron, 6 foot tall obelisks that seem so, you know, from another planet and another time that initially marked our border. And he's been sort of systematically going and photographing those, but in order to get access to some of the area, because of the drug and human trafficking, he's been working or had to initially ask for permission of and then has been working with the Border Patrol and has been sort of navigating that highly politicized, you know, literal and metaphoric landscape.
Right.
And so that's a fascinating project for me. Another photographer who I deeply respect and admire is Erica Blumenfeld,
right.
who is one of, you know, was here in Santa Fe for so long and has really tried to heighten our awareness about just issues surrounding light and the effect that light plays. And obviously the light is, you know, they talk about the power of vision as the king of the senses. And so her entire body of work is really about perception and about light. And she has spent time in New Mexico, and she's now based in Marfa, Texas, which is one of the great sort of vast grassland areas in the United States.
And she had that show here that had her photographs of Antarctica.
Exactly. And so she's been dealing with the land for a long time and dealing with our perception of the land specifically through by looking at and calling into question how we perceive light. So she's fantastic. Those are a few of my favorites, yeah.
There is another question that was raised in Lucy Lepard's essay of if you were going to, there she lives in Galisteo and says, well, I don't think I want any land art in my little rural
right.
community, but
right.
if we were to have some, what would we have? And one of the candidates was something that I find fascinating, which is artists who are working with others to restore land.
Yeah.
And Patricia Johansson was on the show not too long ago doing amazing projects that, I guess, blur the line between what we call art and ecological restoration and sewage plants and things like that.
And that's something also that Malin Wilson Powell brings up in her essay, which is this the syncretic sort of practice that we have where it's you know, it's almost like today it's so difficult to define what land art is because it's everything from, you know, these sort of monumental permanent things down to the very ephemeral, like you said, really just trying to deal with ecological restoration and bringing awareness to, you know, cities and how people interact with, you know, for instance, in Albuquerque, how people interact with the Bosque area and the Rio Grande. And another piece that is one of my favorite, which I didn't have a chance to actually witness, but it was Basia Erlan's ice blocks, where she had created these blocks of ice that were carved in the shape of books. Who doesn't love something carved in the shape of a book? That she then had embedded with all of these natural seeds, which they sort of like set, you know, she set float in the river, and then the you know, it's a very, again, it's a very ephemeral piece where the ice blocks melt and essentially the seeds are scattered in order to sort of repair and bring back to life the edges of the waterways and all of that. So it's fascinating.
It is fascinating because, of course, you could just scatter the seeds.
Exactly, and why call it an artwork? But again, this, you know, there's an element of. So I've talked with, you know, many of the artists, and sometimes this idea of having lost, you know, like for instance, there's a desire to look back at previous cultures, particularly within the land art movement, I think, and to see what it's almost like we want to educate ourselves on what is a healthy and an appropriate relationship with the land. Obviously, you know, issues, you know, we've got the entire Gulf of Mexico oil disaster, which is caused by our desire to extract things from the land in order to continue our society and all of our technology. And yet we can see every day how that has destroyed the very land from which we are pulling, you know, pulling this material out of. And so there's a desire to look back at previous cultures, many of which had some kind of like rites of passage or ways of interacting that were ritualized in a way that was educative. And I think there's almost like a desire to, and a healthy desire, to find a way to not ritualize in a negative way, but recapture a very public aspect of interacting with the land. So these kinds of they're almost like performance pieces, I think, tie into that a very human desire to, in a public act, you know, show and bear witness to a relationship to the land. And, you know, and that's something I think that people can learn, that we can learn from each other that way.
We're talking to Darius Himes about the new book, Land Art, by Radius Books. One of my favorites was a piece called Here's Looking at You, and it's by Patrick Doherty, and it was assisted by the children in the Bosque School in Albuquerque, and basically they used invasive species, trees, to make these wonderful sculptures that I can't even describe. You're going to have to go look at this book. But talk about rites of passage and educating children on about invasive species and having a wonderful time doing it.
Yeah, it's true. One of the most unfortunate things of our contemporary public discourse is the fact that is that it's so difficult to get funding for the arts in schools. And the arts can play such an educative role in really training young minds and young souls to be more conscious of their surroundings, to be more engaged in a respectful and thoughtful way. And Patrick's piece about where they gathered together all of these, it was locally harvested willow branches, and they created these amazing sculptures that look like these faces. It's really fantastic. And many of the artists had things that were quite, had pieces that were quite interactive. And there's definitely throughout this group of projects a thread of I want to say science-based arts. It operates in an area where there is quite a desire to somehow blend science and art together in a way to heighten awareness.
Which I think is a wonderful trend that should be encouraged as much as is humanly possible.
Yeah.
Because those are groups that are, I think, artificially separated particularly in the second half of the previous century.
Yeah, totally. Art and science, they can inform each other and work together for the common good, if you will.
Aren't we getting lofty
no,
here?
But it's a little
true.
Heady. But
no, it's true.
I mean, just to spell that out a bit, the idea of, in many ways, we are, the history of the 20th century and the last half of the 19th century is very much, so many things that we take for granted are very new in the history of society, in the history of human organization. The ability to travel to the ends of the earth, within a 24-hour period, for instance,
right.
Or even things that we take for granted, like universal education, we tend to forget that this concept, the attempt to implement the idea of universal education is really barely 100 years old. I mean, so in the blink of human history, it's such a new thing, and I think that being able to draw on all of the disciplines, science and the arts and social sciences, all of this to really, the phrase the common good sounds so lofty, but at the same time, we are very actively building something as groups of people from all over the planet.
Right.
And I think that's something to address.
And in a way, the fact that we even think it's a lofty term and as opposed to a common term is something
right.
that
yeah, exactly.
That's not so great. I mean, that's what we are all or should all be working for
exactly.
in our lives.
Exactly.
Darius Himes is acquisition editor at Radius Books, which is a publisher right here in Santa Fe. And the new book is called Land Art New Mexico. And the book will be presented at Collected Works Bookstore on Tuesday, the 6th of July at 6 in the evening. It's great to have you on the air, and we hope to have more Radius Books as time goes by.
Thank you so much, Rachel.
I'm very happy now to welcome Teresa Davis and Rich Forer. They are with the Interfaith Peace Builders delegation that recently returned from Israel and the West Bank. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So what were you doing in Israel and the West Bank?
We were in Israel and the West Bank primarily to meet with nonviolent opposition groups in both Israel and Palestine, or the West Bank. And we were with a group of people led by Anna Baltzer, who is a Jewish-American woman who spent time in the West Bank with the International Women's Peace Service.
Who's been on this show.
Who has been on this show, indeed. and with Kathy Sultan, who is an American woman as well, who spent many years living in Lebanon and was there, I think, through both Lebanese, Israel-Lebanon wars.
And so you were meeting with people who were basically involved with peace movements on both sides of the conflict.
Well, not totally. We did meet with the ideological settler movement also, who I don't think we could characterize them as being part of the peace movement. They're part of the settlement movement.
Right, okay. So let's talk about the various people you met with.
So we met, as Rich said, with a variety of groups. Both groups involved in active nonviolent resistance and groups that were sort of representative of both Palestinian and Israeli society. I was particularly struck by a woman we met in Sderot, which is on the border with Gaza. It's an Israeli town, and it's been at the center of a lot of the reports of rocket fire coming from Gaza, whether by Hamas or Islamic Jihad, into Israel. This woman's name was Nomika Zion. She lived in an urban kibbutz in Sderot, and she began her presentation to us by talking about the very traumatic experience of living on the border with Gaza, of living under constant rocket fire. But she went on to say to us, "I have never felt as safe and as protected by my government as I did when my government signed a ceasefire with Hamas." This was in the summer of 2008. And she said, "The moment Israel broke that ceasefire on November 4th, I knew what was coming." And what was coming from her perspective was 24 hours a day, the walls shaking, hearing the bombardment of a civilian population that was only 5 kilometers away. And so through the process of living on this border, she decided that it was important to speak to Gazans. And she said, historically, people in Sderot have had relationships to people in Gaza. They've gone over to Gaza, gone to the beach in Gaza. And so her effort was to sort of reconstruct those relationships through this incredibly hostile relationship. And so through Facebook and phone calls and whatever other methods they have, they've continued talking. This is a group called Other Voice.
So they're not... Is there a wall there separating them, or can they also meet face-to-face?
They cannot meet face-to-face. They have held protests, simultaneous protests, walking along the border next to each other on either side. But I believe there's a fence now. I don't know if it's a full-blown wall, as there is between East Jerusalem and sort of Eastern Israel and the West Bank.
Also, we went to another kibbutz in Sderot, Kibbutz Zikim, I think it was called, and the man we spoke to there said he has never felt so betrayed in his life by his government, and he was absolutely enraged, and he said it was because he basically echoed Nomika from Other Voice, which is that by invading Gaza, Israel exponentially increased the number of rockets that were launched from Gaza that were landing in Sderot. In fact, both places had had a rocket land on their property the day before we got there.
Good heavens.
Yeah.
So basically what they were saying, if you were going to sum it up, was fighting leads to more fighting.
Correct.
Precisely.
Gee, that's a new thought.
No. There you have it.
So one of the conversations that you entered into with some of the people and groups with whom you met was, if you're going to protest an occupation, if you're going to try to really do peace activism, how do you do it?
Yes, and one of the interesting questions that was raised for me on this trip was the question of dialogue groups and of how effective dialogue groups are in combating something like an occupation, in which the balance of power is so profoundly skewed towards one side. And we saw that. I mean, we saw the difference between an industrial military Israel and a very agricultural Palestine. And many people within what is called the BDS movement in the West Bank and Gaza,
the what
and
movement?
Around the world, the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, will say these dialogue groups promote the idea that there's an equality of power between Israelis and Palestinians, and that somehow this conflict is primarily due to ancestral, religious, fundamental hatreds that can be overcome through this kind of conversation, rather than due to a much more cut and dry military occupation by one country of another country. I'm not sure what I think about it. We met with Omar Barghouti, who is the head of the Palestinian Academic and Cultural Boycott Campaign, and he voiced this opinion very strongly and very convincingly. But we also met with groups such as Nomikas,
Combatants for Peace,
Kids for Peace, which are engaged in sort of a more dialogue-based approach to conflict resolution. And they were wonderful. And to me, they demonstrated the power of individuals to really overcome the kind of hatreds that can be socialized into a society.
Well, it seems like maybe both of those things are useful right. in their place.
Right. Well, one of the things I got out of the trip was I'm all for dialogue groups. We met with a friend of mine who lives in Ma'ale Adumim, which is an Israeli settlement just outside of Jerusalem. And she was a member of Mayor Kahani's group for 15 years, Kach, Mayor Kahani's group is designated as a terrorist group by both Israel, the European Union, and the United States. And Leah was a member of that group, and she had a transformation during the Second Intifada in the year 2000 after two of her daughters had good friends killed in suicide bomb attacks, two of her daughters in two separate incidents. And she realized that there had to be another way. And so she now is part of Interfaith Encounters, and she has dialogue groups with Palestinians. And there is kind of a paradox in the fact that she does live in an illegal settlement, although she's kind of stuck there. But the thing that she impressed upon me is how important it is to dialogue with the Palestinians rather than not being able to see them, because most Israelis do not see Palestinians. The wall prevents them from seeing the Palestinians. And so for me, dialogue is important because it can change the consciousness of people. On the other hand, what Omar Barghouti was saying, and which I agree with, is if you give the impression that there's a symmetrical relationship, that the problem is because Palestinians and Israelis can't get along, because Palestinians and Israelis always resort to violence, it gives an impression that there's an equal responsibility.
Right.
When in fact, when you have one country with a million times more power, military power,
firepower
than another, and that country has been using a legal system to dispossess the other people and leave them with nothing, that's not a symmetrical relationship. So I would like to say simply to dialogue groups, the dialogue groups are great, but please make it clear that you understand that this is an asymmetrical relationship between one country that is the occupier and another that is the unwitting occupied.
We're talking to Teresa Davis and Rich Forer from Interfaith Peace Builders. You met with somebody who was imprisoned by the Israeli government for protesting.
Yes, we did. We met with Kobi Snitz, who actually heads Boycott From Within, which is the Israeli response to the 2005 Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. And Kobi, I don't know his full history, so I won't pretend to be an expert on him. He's actually an academic who got his PhD here in the United States, and he has been a part of protests against the wall in Bilin and I think in Nilin as well, all along the border of the West Bank. And he was the first Israeli to be imprisoned for an extended period of time for protesting alongside Palestinians. And he's representative of a very small movement of Israelis who have said, we support the Palestinian Liberation Movement, we support the Palestinian leadership of this movement, and we're not going to impose our standards on that movement. We're going to follow and do what we can to assist a Palestinian-led movement opposing the occupation.
So what we Americans would call freedom of speech and freedom of protest is not necessary. Of course, we don't have that here because, as we know, people were taken away for wearing anti-Bush t-shirts during the Bush era, but basically that's a non-freedom of speech situation right. That you were looking at there.
Right. Also, we went to Birzeit University in Ramallah, which is a very nice university, and it has high standards, I think. And It became clear to us, well, we were told that 10% of the student body of that university are in detention. In other words, they've been taken by the police, by Israeli police, and put in detention. Now, when you're in detention, there's no charge. You haven't been charged with anything. And Israel, by Israeli law, can keep you in detention for 6 months without charging you. But what Israel often will do is they'll keep you in prison, and then just before the end of the 6 month, they'll renew the detention. And we met with someone, I can't remember his name, who was in prison for 7 years without ever being charged. Israel just kept renewing their order. And one of the things we learned at Beer Zeit is that I don't know if illegal is the word, but Israel prohibits that university from having any organizations. So if you have an organization that speaks up for Palestinian rights, Israel may come and just arrest you and put you in detention. And theoretically, it can be any group. And I asked one of the people, I said, so in other words, if there was a group here that was studying Hebrew and Jewish history, theoretically, because it's a group, an organization, that the members could be arrested and put in detention? And the answer is yes.
I think it's also important to say that this is a dynamic that has affected Israeli universities as well. And recently, there's been a huge backlash against professors who call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. There was a professor who received a death threat, and there's actually a bill in the Knesset making it illegal to call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the state of Israel.
A bill that hasn't been passed yet.
It has not yet been passed, but it's being considered.
Now, Teresa, both of you are Jewish. You went there with your grandmother, who was a Holocaust refugee who left Europe in the late 1930s.
I did. We decided to go on this trip together for various reasons, particularly because it had been a topic we discussed and disagreed about frequently. And she has always felt very strongly that Israel is necessary, that Israel is legitimate, that it is the homeland of the Jewish people, and I think she still believes that. For her, this trip was very shocking, not only because of the experience of what the occupation has become and the militarization of Israeli society, but also because of her, I think, very surprising identification with Palestinians. And we had one incredible.
As refugees.
And so this happened particularly in Dehesha, which is a refugee camp in Bethlehem, just outside of Jerusalem, where people have been living since 1948 and have been disallowed from returning to their homes, which sometimes are only 10 kilometers away. And we were sitting there listening to a presentation by a woman who had lived through what Palestinians call the Nakba in 1948, the catastrophe, their expulsion. And my grandmother raised her hand and she said, I too am a refugee. And I've had it easier because I am allowed to go back to Czechoslovakia, or to what is now the Czech Republic. But I understand the experience of dispossession and of living one's whole life knowing that one has lost one's home.
Very interesting. Now, you, Rich, for also are Jewish, and at some point in your life, you had a kind of change of heart about the Israel-Palestinian situation.
Correct. In 2006, in the midst of the war in Lebanon, which I was very gung-ho about, I supported Israel totally. But at some point during that war, I had an argument with a couple friends who did not support the war, and it spurred me to decide, you know what, I really need to investigate this myself, because I realized that most of what I believed had come from one book, Joan Peters' book from time immemorial, which has been deeply debunked, I learned later. But so I decided to start reading, and I started reading books, and I checked the sources. I only read Jewish authors, and I checked whenever I read something that was footnoted, which was a lot, I made sure that the author was, I went and checked that footnote, the source, because I wanted to make sure the author was not taking something out of context or simply lying. And what I learned was so shocking that I experienced a transformation of the heart.
What did you learn?
What I learned is that that the vast majority of Palestinians have always engaged in a nonviolent protest against the Israeli occupation. And what I learned internally, I guess I would say, is that no matter how abhorrent some of the tactics have been in the war on terror, in the fight against Israel from both sides, the people committing these acts of terror, I'm going to speak about the Palestinians, let's talk for a moment about suicide bombers. When someone has no hope for a future, when they've grown up and seen their parents being humiliated, beaten, called whores, and every day they grow up and see Israeli soldiers occupying their land, and they feel there's no future, eventually a small percentage will resort to violence. I don't agree with the tactic, but most of these people are young, and when they commit suicide bomb attacks, it's the only way they know, no matter how tragic an expression of meeting the need for self-determination and freedom, it's the only way they know to let the world know that they are suffering. And so the antidote is for Israel to make peace with the Palestinians.
Well, and I think one of the very interesting things that you just said is that the vast majority of people protesting are protesting nonviolently.
Correct.
And in fact, as we talked about before we got on the air earlier, is that a lot of these Palestinian people who you met are looking to Martin Luther King and other nonviolent protesters from history and Gandhi.
Gandhi, yeah. Yes, in fact, in the first Intifada in 1987, Israel arrested or deported almost all of the nonviolent leaders, the leaders of the nonviolent movement, including Mubarak Awad, who was a Gandhi disciple, you could say. And at the same time they did that, they collaborated with the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood to create Hamas, and they allowed Sheikh Yassin, the spiritual leader of Hamas, to distribute anti-Jewish hate literature calling for the overthrow of Israel. They allowed him to do what he was doing, but they deported or arrested all of the nonviolent leaders. That tells you something.
Very interesting. We've heard a lot in this country, in our media, about Palestinian houses being demolished. Mohammed Omer was on the show, and his house was demolished with his mother in it. Luckily, she survived, but with a lot of injuries. You had an experience of a house that was slated for demolition. Tell us that, Teresa.
Well, there were several experiences. The first-hand experience we had was with a couple, Teresa, and you'll have to remind me of
Ali.
His name, Ali. In Sahnin, just outside of Nazareth in the Galilee. And their house was slated for demolition because the zoning had been changed for their plot of land because it fell within the sort of buffer zone or the municipal jurisdiction of a settlement. Do you want to add anything to their story?
Well, I want to mention that Ali had met his wife Teresa when Ali was living in Norway. Teresa is a Norwegian. And when they decided to move back to the Middle East, Ali's father gave them an acre of land, which he had owned for a long time. And so they built the house there. Subsequent to their building the house, Israel took land for a Jewish-only settlement. Most of the land they took was private, which is very common. And because of the way they Israel delineated their boundaries, they took a small piece of Ali's land. So that, from the Israeli point of view, that meant because now, after the fact of the house being built, because now some of the land that the house was sitting on was now part of a Jewish settlement, Israel said, part of your land is now part of our Jewish settlement. That can't be. We have to demolish your house. And they issued a demolition order.
Aye, aye, aye.
And so one thing to say that I was unaware of when I first arrived in Israel and the West Bank is that demolitions don't take place just as a punitive measure against families who've had a family member involved in a suicide attack or in, you know, a violent resistance movement. A lot of the time, they're part of a very calculated strategy which is designed either to make life miserable for Palestinians or, in the case of East Jerusalem in particular, to make life so difficult that Palestinians actually leave a particular area. And this is very well documented. There are groups like the Israeli Coalition Against Home Demolitions who have monitored East Jerusalem and the West Bank and have found that there are very specific zoning laws in East Jerusalem designed to maintain the demographic balance of Jerusalem at around 70% Israeli or Jewish and 30% Palestinian. And so people have had enormous troubles trying to construct their houses with expanding families, and many Palestinians live under threat of demolition order. And having a demolition order doesn't necessarily mean that your house will be demolished the next day, and so you sit and wait, and you don't know if you'll be next.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was trying to imagine what it was like, and I was just thinking, what if it were my house that I've lived in for 12 years and that I own, and there was continual threat of it being demolished at any moment. It's unimaginable. But we've got just a few minutes left. I know that both of you, having been on this trip to Israel and the West Bank, had real changes in what you might call stereotypical views of Palestinian people, of Arab people.
It was quite surprising for me to realize that even as an educated progressive American, having been to college at the University of Chicago, having Arab friends, I still held these views of the Arab world and of the Muslim world as somehow fundamentally different from my own world. And one of the most interesting things to me is this argument that, for example, nuclear deterrence won't work with a Middle Eastern country because they're too fanatical. They don't care about their families. They'll annihilate Israel or the United States without any sense of self-preservation. And that had never occurred to me as something that was fundamentally wrong.
And your experience was that that was incorrect.
And my experience was that that was incorrect in both a personal way, in that I met many Palestinians, and they're not fanatical Islamist Jew haters for the most part. They're people who want their land back. Which is something I can really sympathize with. And then also, you know, just in the further reading, realizing people like John Mearsheimer will say deterrence worked for years with the crazy communists, with the Bolsheviks, even though we held these same ideas about, you know, the Reds. And so to realize that that history of antagonistic foreign policy, of antagonistic relationships to others is being repeated in this situation was very profound for me.
Also, for me, I'd say 90% of my change of heart happened almost 4 years ago, but the other 10% was seeing just how warm the Palestinians were. I felt completely safe anywhere I went. I got lost in the Arab quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. Palestinians came up to me, young men in their 20s, and they were extremely helpful. They sent a kid to lead me to the Jaffa Gate, which is where I was trying to find. And the kid was real nice, and when we got to where we were going, he just turned around and was ready to go. I had to grab him and make him take 10 shekels from me for being so nice. And everywhere I went, every Palestinian I met, I told them right up front, I just naturally felt like telling them that I was Jewish, and I didn't notice the slightest contraction in them or the slightest sense of bigotry whatsoever. And in fact, the most common thing I heard was, it's not about Jews, it's not about Muslims, it's not about Christians, it's about human beings. And we don't want revenge. All we want is to be able to live in peace with our Jewish neighbors.
Teresa Davis and Rich Forer are with the Interfaith Peace Builders delegation that returned just recently from Israel and the West Bank. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the final hour of Good Morning Jazz features the artist of the month, Count Basie. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.